Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On December 10th, 2007, the Supreme Court decided Kimbrough v. United States and Gall v. United States, two important cases dealing with the sentencing guidelines. In this episode of SCOTUS Cast, Stefanos Bibas, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, offers his own analysis of the case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Bibas.
This is Professor Stefanos Bibas of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, podcasting on the Supreme Court's November 10, 2007 decisions in Gall v. United States and Kimbrough v. United States. In the Apprendi v. New Jersey line of cases, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Sixth Amendment to require jury findings of fact for all facts that raise a defendant's statutory maximum sentence. In Blakely, the court extended Apprendi to all facts that raise the defendant's sentencing guidelines maximum. And in the Booker v. United States case, the court held that because there weren't jury findings of fact under the federal sentencing guidelines, those guidelines would now be advisory rather than mandatory. The cases since Booker have been fights over what Booker means. The Rita case last year held that courts of appeals may presume within guideline sentences are reasonable. And the Claiborne case was supposed to decide whether the further a sentence departs from the guidelines, the stronger its justification must be. But it was mooted by Claiborne's untimely death. So this term, the court returned to this set of issues interpreting Booker in two cases. The one that's gotten more press attention is the Kimbrough versus United States case, which has to do with the disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentences. Ultimately, I think, though, it may be less important in the long term. The federal sentencing guidelines for years have treated 1 gram of crack cocaine as the equivalent of 100 grams of powder cocaine, which winds up meaning that crack sentences are often 3 to 6 times longer than powder cocaine sentences. The U.S. Sentencing Commission has repeatedly recommended reducing that crack-powder ratio, in part because of the perceived disparate racial impact on minorities, but Congress has blocked reforms. So, in the Kimbrough case, Derek Kimbrough had pleaded guilty to trafficking in both crack and powder cocaine. The guidelines called for sentences of 19 to 22 and a half years, but if it had been powder cocaine alone, his sentence would have only been 8 to 9 years. The district court in that case decided to vary the sentence downwards, not 19 years, but 15 years. The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit vacated the sentence, holding it was impermissible for the district court to just disagree with the 100-to-1 crack cocaine ratio and to substitute its own judgment on that. But the U.S. Supreme Court reversed and ruled for Kimbrough. It held that a district judge may disagree with the guidelines crack-powder disparity, and on the basis of that policy disagreement may decide to impose a below-guideline sentence. And this is quite shocking to guidelines veterans because district courts ordinarily were supposed to be individualizing but not implementing their own policies. The first surprise here is that the government has conceded that a district court may reject the Sentencing Commission's policy decisions. As the court says in Kimbrough, the government acknowledges that the guidelines are now advisory and that as a general matter, courts may vary from guidelines ranges based solely on policy considerations, including disagreements with the guidelines. Now, the U.S. government tried to argue this case was special, that Congress's 1986 Act mandated the 100-to-1 ratio, but that statute governs only maximum and minimum sentences, not what goes on in between the guidelines. So the Supreme Court rejected that argument. The court also approved of the district court's not adopting a ratio on its own. What that means, perversely, is that a district court, each district judge now, can vary ad hoc, but it can't spell out clearly what it's doing or what ratio it thinks is appropriate. We can't have a gelling of precedent over time of the accumulated wisdom of different district courts to help long-term generate some uniformity. The second interesting holding of Kimbrough is that avoiding disparity is a goal, but it's only one goal. For a long time, the courts have repeated the mantra, the need for uniformity, which was an important goal of the Sentencing Reform Act. But this Supreme Court is now emphasizing the need for flexibility to individualize sentences. and that that can trump the need for uniformity here. A third interesting part of Kimbrough is that the decision itself may be specific to crack cocaine, because the commission itself does not throw its own expertise behind the crack guidelines. It's been trying to amend them for years. Congress has blocked it. So it's hard to generalize from Kimbrough. Indeed, the day after this decision was handed down, the Sentencing Commission agreed to make its recent lowering of crack penalties retroactive, which benefits thousands of crack convicts who are already in prison. Let me move on to the Gall case. Gall, I think, is the more important of the two cases. The facts are that while he was in college, Brian Gall was a drug user. He joined an ecstasy distribution ring and netted about $30,000 from being a part of it for 7 months. After the 7 months, he voluntarily withdrew, stopped selling drugs, and found steady legal work. In this case, along with half a dozen or so co-defendants, he pleaded guilty to participating in this ecstasy distribution ring. And the guideline sentence that was prescribed was 30 to 37 months. Well, most of his co-conspirators got sentences within the guidelines around there. But the district court decided to depart downward for Gall from 30 to 37 months imprisonment down to 36 months of probation with no imprisonment. The holding in Gall reversed the Eighth Circuit and affirmed the district court's imposition of an outside below guidelines sentence. While the degree of variance the court held from the guidelines is relevant, there's no presumption of unreasonableness for outside guideline sentences. Courts should review both within and beyond guideline sentences alike under a deferential abuse of discretion standard. Now, the Supreme Court had hinted that it was going this direction in the Rita case, but Gall makes it much more explicit. A couple of interesting factors here. The first thing is that the opinion in Kimbrough was written by Justice Ginsburg. The opinion in Gall is written by Justice Stevens. They are two of the Apprendi Five who seem to have broken away from their more radical brethren, Scalia, Thomas, and Souter. They seem to be the ones steering the court now. And they also are in league with Chief Justice Roberts, Kennedy, and Breyer, who seem to be exercising a moderating influence. We're going to see some dicta that are, some of them point towards a more Stevens direction of emphasizing individualization, but others sound like they're written by or to please Justice Breyer, emphasizing the continued need for uniformity and the continued importance of the guidelines. So to move on in Stevens' opinion, Stevens stresses in his majority opinion that courts must avoid a rigid mathematical proportionality requirement or a requirement of extraordinary circumstances for varying from the guidelines. Though either a mathematical proportionality requirement or an extraordinary circumstances requirement comes too close to creating an impermissible presumption of unreasonableness for outside guideline sentences. Courts may treat guideline sentences as reasonable, but they may not treat beyond guideline sentences as presumptively unreasonable. Again, this is just an elaboration on the Rita case. The guidelines are the starting point for analysis, but not the ending point. They generally distill the empirical evidence and careful study of the Sentencing Commission. So the Sentencing Commission still matters. It still should carry some weight in people's minds. Courts are to consider all the factors laid out in 18 U.S.C. 3553A. They're to individualize sentences according to the totality of the circumstances. And courts are to individualize in ways that aren't reducible to quantifiable considerations or percentages. You can't presume that the guidelines are reasonable. You can't presume that any reduction has to be 5% or 10%. That can't be codified. However, the court does acknowledge that a major departure, whatever that means, should be supported by a more significant justification than a minor one. So there still may be some sliding scale where the further away one moves from the guidelines range, the more scrutiny or the more justification is required. Finally, Justice Stevens emphasizes the need to defer to district courts who have an institutional advantage in justifying sentences. This is interesting because more than a decade ago, in Coon versus United States, the Supreme Court had embraced abuse of discretion review of district courts' guidelines determinations. Congress had reversed that in the PROTECT Act and had demanded de novo review. And in essence, that requirement of the PROTECT Act has been abrogated. Blakely, in effect, has been read to strike down the PROTECT Act's de novo review requirement. It's important, the court stresses finally, to treat like cases alike. Uniformity is a value. But as in this case, where one co-defendant is much more sympathetic than others, it's also important to treat unlike cases unlike. That is a factor we're going to see a lot of defense lawyers raising in saying that their client was the most minor participant in a conspiracy, that the guidelines need to be tweaked to make sure that the low-level people get lower sentences than their more culpable brethren. The concurrences in this case come from the more extreme or robust supporters of the Apprendi line of cases. Justice Scalia wants to stress that defendants can still challenge guideline sentences as unconstitutional as applied. He underscores that he's not crazy about the Booker remedy of making the guidelines advisory. He would rather have had juries finding these facts. But he wants to stress that constitutional Sixth Amendment challenges are still available case by case. And Justice Souter, in a one paragraph concurrence, says, I'm not going to beat a dead horse, but Booker and Rita still loom over us. It would have been better if we had mandatory guidelines and had juries finding facts. The dissents, interestingly, go in opposite directions. Justice Thomas appears to be the most radical of the Apprendi supporters, the most committed. And he says he's still rejecting the Booker remedy. He was in dissent in Booker, and he's unlike Scalia and Souter in being willing to go along grudgingly. Juries, he says, should be the ones finding sentencing facts, not judges. Justice Alito, on the other side, dissents because he thinks that the majority is not giving enough weight to the guidelines. District courts, he says, ought to give some significant weight to the policy choices embodied in the guidelines, and courts of appeals must still police compliance with them. He stresses, interestingly, and with some persuasion, that the district court here relied on some factors, like the lack of criminal history, that the commission had already taken into account, and other factors, such as youth and support from family, that the commission had reasonably decided were irrelevant. So perhaps the majority is saying that district courts can reject these sentencing commission efforts to have some uniform policy on whether age is an aggravating or mitigating factor, whether family circumstances are aggravating or mitigating or ought to be left out. That was one of the very important efforts of the Sentencing Commission to harmonize disparate views on these subjects, and the Supreme Court may in essence be tossing all of that work out. So what's the upshot of these cases? In the short term, Gall and Kimbrough look like they are modest wins for defendants. The court is reiterating that it means what it said in Booker and Rita. The guidelines are truly advisory. District courts can deviate from them, and they won't necessarily be reversed for doing it. In the longer term, however, it looks to me like Breyer may have snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Remember that there were 5 votes for Apprendi, 5 votes for Blakely, to keep pushing this right to require more jury involvement in sentencing and more individualization. But Breyer and Kennedy and Roberts, it looks like, have stolen away Ginsburg and Stevens and their thunder. So in the long term, we're going to have thousands of judges and lawyers who've grown up under the guideline system. And the guidelines, we're told, are still the starting point. Lawyers continue to begin by computing them, which then sets a mental anchor that's going to keep sentences relatively close to where the judges started. The judges might give a 10% discount, but they're giving a 10% discount from a guideline starting point. And if judges don't start with the guidelines and don't compute them correctly, there's still going to be procedural reversible error here. Moreover, the further a judge is from the guidelines, the greater the justification needed. So guidelines still remain a safer harbor. Maybe they're not 100% safe anymore, but they're probably 99.8% safe. My own analysis is we may have wound up in the worst of both worlds here. We'll have liberal circuits, such as the Second and Ninth Circuits, taking these cases as an invitation to more disparity, to vary more from the guidelines. We'll still, however, have conservative circuits, like the Fourth and Eighth Circuits, that'll stick relatively close to the guidelines. But here's the kicker. The courts can't be honest about what they're doing. If a district court is honest about applying a mathematical ratio, well, that contradicts what Justice Ginsburg said in Kimbrough. you can't say we're going to adopt a 20-to-1 rather than 100-to-1 ratio, or at least that's a hint in Kimbrough. So district judges can do so in the back of their minds, but they can't do so transparently. Courts of appeals can't say that they're going to be hard on beyond guideline sentences, or they're going to review them with close scrutiny. But they can do it in the back of their mind if they're not very open about it. It reminds me a little bit of the unsatisfying compromise of the court in the Grutter and Gratz affirmative action cases. The University of Michigan undergraduate made clear that it was giving a certain percentage advantage to minority applicants. That got struck down. The University of Michigan Law School was, in effect, trying to achieve the same percentages of diversity, trying to achieve the same outcomes, but it did so through a less transparent process. 7 of the 9 justices saw that there was no real difference between the two systems. But in the end, the court upheld it because it was less honest, less transparent, less in-your-face about affirmative action. My final concerns about these cases are, first of all, that they gut appellate review as a guarantor of consistency. What does it mean to keep sentences consistent if the appellate courts can't say openly, we're going to require an extremely strong justification because this sentence is less than half of the guideline sentence? That would seem to send clearer signals to the district courts and to the litigants to predict outcomes. Now, however, it's not clear whether appellate courts will be able to police consistency or whether they will at least do so with the vigor that you might want to avoid discrimination and arbitrariness. My final concern, though, is that the Apprendi line of cases in 7 years has gone very far astray. The whole justification for upending dozens of state sentencing systems was that the Sixth Amendment required jury findings. Now we have a series of state systems that have been rewritten. We have the Supreme Court veering away from the Sixth Amendment, not saying anything about the Sixth Amendment in these cases, rewriting acts of Congress and Sentencing Commission rules, regulations, case law, etc., on grounds that have nothing to do with juries, nothing to do with the Sixth Amendment, that are about fine-tuning the balance between district courts and court of appeals. It may be wise policy. The sentencing guidelines may have become too rigid and needed some flexibility, but why that's the job of the Supreme Court rather than Congress is a question that's left poorly answered.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.